A recent project that measured the reliability of cancer research revealed a serious problem. Labs are often unable to repeat published experiments and get the same results. In an article for Wired called "The Young Billionaire Behind the War on Science," Sam Appel talks to the researchers who are creating a movement to fix the situation and profiles John Arnold, a young billionaire who has pledged half his fortune to debunking bad science research, including flawed cancer studies. Sam Appel joins us now, along with biologist Tim Errington, who led the cancer replication project of the Center for Open Science. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tim, what happened when scientists try to repeat the results in this particular cancer biology replication project?
Yeah, so I think the easiest answer is that we had, you know, a variety of mixed responses. So as simple as not even being able to get the experimental system to behave the same way, all the way to not at all seeing the same result. And I think, you know, there's a lot of possible explanations for that, and you know, it really points to the fact that, you know, right now we think whenever we publish a result or you see some finding, you take it as fact, you take it as reliable evidence. And I think what this is starting to show us is that any piece of evidence, whether it's that first exciting discovery or somebody's attempt, that you need more evidence, that you know replication is a way to kind of expose more of that process, more understanding of, you know, what was actually observed.
Does the failure to replicate results mean that the initial findings were wrong?
No, I mean, that's one of many, many possibilities, but no, it doesn't. So one is, like you pointed out, it could be that the original was wrong or it was a false positive. It could also be that ours was a false negative, right? We failed to observe the effect. Or maybe, you know, we did something wrong. Probably what's the most likely, though, is that they're probably both right, potentially. And that we just are not communicating efficiently. Right? Uh-huh. There's something that was observed in the original. We tried to do the exact same thing, and there's some disconnect. There's something missing. And, you know, basically we need to figure that out, right? Because if we can't translate it from one lab to another lab, that's not really a great way of accumulating knowledge.
How does that affect cancer drug testing?
Well, I think, yeah, that's a really good point, right? So whenever we're developing cancers or moving anything into this therapy realm, you know, there's kind of two main means with which we do that. We do what are called, you know, conceptual replications, or basically that's the equivalent of gathering more information. And, you know, that's vital, right? We want to make sure that we test it in multiple animals, that we test it in, you know, mice, as well as in cell lines, as well as, if we can, in patient samples. And what we're looking at is saying, well, you know, that's vital, but we need to have this assumed, you know, this assumption right now that we're taking, but we need to check how reliable is each piece of that evidence. And so I think this kind of points out the need to do this a little bit more often. And it doesn't mean that you would do it for everything, but it is probably not a bad idea just to not assume the evidence is reliable, but to actually, you know, continually check it every once in a while, especially for those kind of key points.
Sam, you spoke to Tim's colleague Brian Nosek, the co-founder of the Center for Open Science. When did he realize that science, as you write, had become biased toward generating a certain kind of finding, novel, attention-grabbing, but ultimately unreliable?
Brian sort of became aware of this problem a number of years ago. I think as far back as 10 years ago or more, he started, you know, noticing problems in science. And, you know, he, in his own research, studies unconscious biases, so it made sense for him in a way to apply his own research to science more generally. And over the years, it occurred to him that, you know, a lot of these problems could be fixed with relatively straightforward solutions. So he had this idea, he and one of his graduate students, that they would work together and create software that would help scientists put all their data online and measure or sort of state online what they're trying to do. That way, if it's all available and other researchers can look at it, they can reproduce the results or they have an opportunity to do it. So he was thinking about this for quite a while now, but it took a long time for sort of the rest of the academic world and the scientific community to wake up to the importance of the issue. So for a long time, he wanted to do these things but couldn't really raise any money to get these projects off the ground.
He was trying to look into the what's called the file drawer effect?
One issue with science science at the moment is that if you do a study and it turns out not to show anything or doesn't produce the results you're hoping for, you can just put it away, never bring it out into the public, and that's called the file drawer effect. You're essentially putting it into a file drawer and never releasing it. But that's a huge problem because that data is extremely important for other researchers to see. It completely skews the results if you're hiding one experiment and then showing another that happens to work out as you want it.
Tim, did the scientists who try to replicate the results attempt to find the sources of error in the experiment or find out what went wrong?
Yeah, that's a good question. So for the scope of what our project's trying to do, we're trying to get an idea across multiple studies, kind of this breadth approach, right? How do we look at it across multiple studies so we get an idea of what's kind of occurring in the literature, at least in the subset that we're looking at. But we're not doing what you just suggested, which is to dive down deep. And, you know, that does raise a really interesting question, which is how many iterations, how would you have to continually change it until you eventually achieve reproducibility or give up and say, I can't achieve it. And I think, you know, we didn't bother doing that because it's not quite what we're interested in for this project. And again, you'd have to have a lot of resources to do that. But it speaks to Sam's point, which is, you know, if you're sitting here and documenting everything that you're doing, you know, this research, all these research that, you know, we're replicating and that is always constantly funded is years and years of work and you know, kind of the ups and downs of figuring out how a process eventually occurs so that you can get this result that's something that will eventually be useful. And so there's this massive documentation, all these experiments that, you know, didn't quote-unquote work. It's really that they worked, that they informed you that you were on the wrong path. But nobody shares any of that. And so in many ways, when we pick up these papers and we're starting there, you know, the idea is somebody's handing you that torch and saying, here you go, this is how you figure out this exact process. You know, this drug works this way if you, you know, test it this specific way. But since we're not doing that, that's not the norm to share all that information. You know, that's where we get back to these assumptions where, all right, well, based on what I see in your paper and based on what you can tell me, this is what I think works. And it could be that we're repeating the same mistakes over again. And the question would be, how long would we have to spend to get back to the same answer?
Sam, how did the scientific community and funders respond to John Ioannidis's 2005 paper titled Why Most Published Research Findings Are False?
Well, that paper certainly generated a lot of attention, was really crucial to, you know, bringing this subject to the surface. But, that was, you know, more than 10 years ago, and the progress was relatively slow for quite some time. I think that paper was sort of a wake-up call. But, you know, these practices are deeply ingrained. And, you know, as some of the researchers I spoke to talked about, the real problem at the root of this is the incentives are misplaced. So at the moment, if you want to get your study published and, you know, sort of rise the ranks in academia and the scientific community, you have to produce a novel result, an exciting finding in science, and this is the finding that the scientific journals will want to publish. So until you change the incentives, until it becomes exciting to reproduce a study, until it becomes exciting to publish a study that doesn't have exciting results, it's hard to change the structure. So even though that paper was important, the wrong incentives are still in place. And I think that's really the crux of this.
My guests are Sam Apple, whose article, The Young Billionaire Behind the War on Science, is in the February issue of Wired. And we'll talk about that young billionaire in just a moment. Tim Errington is a biologist at the Center for Open Science. So, Sam, who is John Arnold? And how did he become interested in Brian Nosek's work?
John Arnold is a billionaire. He, some years ago, became the youngest billionaire in the country at the time. He was 33 when he became a billionaire. He started at Enron, of all places, and even as Enron was sort of imploding among various various financial scandals were taking place, Arnold was actually sort of untouched by these scandals. He was working in a sort of different area of the firm and actually doing tremendously well, even as Enron was collapsing. He was a financial trader and making hundreds of millions of dollars. So he was really one of the stars of Enron and one of the few people that were at sort of the top of Enron that I think managed to keep his reputation intact. And so he walked away from Enron with a lot of money and started his own hedge fund that was basically doing similar things that he did on Enron, sort of betting on the price of gas or natural gas, you know, what the price would be months or years in advance. And, you know, he was just astonishingly good at it. Some people have referred to him as the greatest trader who's ever lived. And, you know, he made hundreds of millions of dollars for, I think, 7 years in a row. They had 50% returns or more, just unheard of stuff. And then at age 38, he just, you know, walks away from it all. He's made enough money. Things have been changing in the gas markets. He decided he didn't want to do it anymore, and he decides to devote himself to philanthropy. And what's really interesting, I think, is that, you know, there is a clear connect between the two fields. Well, he was working as a trader, you know, he had to pay attention to cause and effect, the same thing that scientists pay attention to. He had to figure out, you know, what sort of factors lead to changes in gas prices. In fact, he even hired a meteorologist and, you know, spent tons of time poring over data. And when he got into the world of philanthropy, he began to see that, you know, the same type of careful attention that he had paid to cause and effect often, you know, wasn't the philanthropic studies that he would look at, you know, studies that were meant to support this or that initiative, actually weren't always very scientific, and the studies weren't always very well done. So he started to pick apart this research, and, you know, it became harder and harder to decide where to give his money to. You know, this guy is very numbers-focused. He's a quant in Wall Street lingo, and it became harder and harder to figure out kind of what was true and not true in the world of philanthropy. And then from there, he started, you know, doing more reading and more research. He read a book by a science journalist named Gary Taubes, and that really, I think, opened his eyes to some extent to say that it's not just small studies on policy that are problematic, that some of these problems really go to the root of science itself in the way that science is being done. And nutrition science is a good example, and then Brian Nosek came along and showed that you know, a lot of these problems exist in psychology as well. So he became interested in supporting all these initiatives that were looking at how to make science better. And Brian Nosek's effort to reproduce psychology studies had gotten a little bit of attention in the Chronicle of Higher Education. So Arnold reached out to him, you know, through his foundation, and said, you know, this is important work, and, you know, what can I do to support it? And that's really what he's done with all these different initiatives. He sees people raising questions about how science is done. He wants to make it better, and he comes along and says, what would you do if you had a lot more money? You know, how would you carry out these studies? And then, you know, from those type of conversations, you know, that led to the work that Tim is doing on trying to reproduce cancer studies and, you know, really a wide range of different projects that are tackling science from different directions.
Well, let me ask Tim about whether there are incentives in science to only produce attention-grabbing or shocking results that will be picked up by the popular media.
You mean, yeah, so the current incentives are very largely put on that, right? So it's not even just the popular media. I think scientists themselves, they need this. You know, papers right now, everybody likes a clean story. You know, I guess we're human. That's kind of the part of it is, you know, we are humans ourselves, and we want to make things very clean and understandable. But the research, especially when you're at that forefront of knowledge, it's nothing but clean and straightforward. So we have this strong incentive to have these stories, have these positive results published. That's the currency in science is these publications, because that's how you get your grant. That's how you're going to get your job. That's how you're going to get your promotion. And so this cycle feeds on itself, and that's why it is this huge cultural shift that needs to occur to start to realign those incentives with, you know, the core principles of science, you know, openness.
Why did you decide to look at cancer biology research?
Sure. So part of it is luck, chance, for myself personally. So earlier in 2012 and 13, two pharma companies, Bayer and Amgen, released white papers, essentially releasing that they had a problem being able to reproduce hallmark cancer studies, and just really more hallmark biomedical studies. And so this is at the exact same time that Brian was doing his psychology project, and in 2013, when the Arnold Foundation, you know, gave Brian funding, Elizabeth Irons at Science Exchange, who are our partners on this project, also approached Brian and was just like, well, this is a really, you know, pressing issue in cancer research. You know, the one catch to those Bayer Amgen reports was there was no data. It was just a white paper. It was just a statement. And so there was a lot of interest to say, well, maybe we should do what Brian was doing in psychology, which is to examine this, but to do it in an open way. And that's how I came along. I essentially found out about it. I was doing my PhD at the University of Virginia and learned about the center, learned about all of this exciting stuff that was happening, and kind of fell into it at the right time, personally, myself, because I myself, as a scientist, was very curious to say, well, it's, you know, there were these really, you know, headline-grabbing claims that science is, you know, broken in some ways. But I definitely wanted to explore it. I wanted to look at it as a scientist and do that scientifically. And I think that's the heart of what we're trying to do with this project.
We have very little time left. But, Sam, not everybody admires John Arnold. Rolling Stone called him a young right-wing kingmaker with clear designs of becoming the next generation's Koch brothers. How does that apply to what we've been talking about?
Well, I think it applies in the sense that...
We have about 30 seconds.
Okay, well, I mean, he's very data-driven, and pension reform is one of the issues that he's focused on because, you know, the numbers don't add up, to put it very quickly. So he wants to work on pension reform in addition to many other areas that he focuses on, and that's been really controversial because, you know, obviously that can lead to, you know, changes in retirement accounts, and that has given him a right-wing reputation, but he's actually been involved with quite a few progressive causes and has been an Obama supporter. So he's a very difficult person to nail down.
And meanwhile, we have this situation where we're hoping that we can clear up just what scientific studies are relevant and which ones are not by the old process of reproducibility. My great thanks to the both of you for being on our show. Sam Apple, whose article, The Young Billionaire Behind the War on Science, is in the February issue of Wired, and Tim Errington, who is a biologist at the Center for Open Science. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.